Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Thank you so much. This is a beautiful day, by the way.
Yeah, it's gorgeous, isn't it? In Hyde Park.
Yeah. So thank you for seeing me today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Before I started recording, I was mentioning to you that a lot of people told me that not to meet with you, right? They told me that this is such a bad idea. I mean, this is like, you don't meet with people like this. It's toxic. People are going to think like you're alt-right and they're not going to take you seriously anymore. What do you think? What should I...
I've done more to fight the alt-right than any of these people.
Yeah.
And they blissfully live in ignorance, being unaware of the sort of things that they do. So they're welcome.
Yeah. Actually, I was mentioning to you that I do follow a lot of the alt-right content, right? And they hate you.
I know.
They hate your guts.
I know.
Right. So I don't know why people associate you with the alt-right. I mean, we had a discussion before, and I was mentioning also to you that I met with a Muslim that I had a show with, that he advocated for killing gays, killing ex-Muslims, sleeping with 9-year-olds, and wife beating, and nobody objected to that, but they think this is a bad idea.
I've got a theory about this. I think it's because the things I'm saying are not particularly radical. I'm actually kind of in some ways, I'm kind of a status quoist, you know, like... A lot of the things that we do are good, and we should continue doing these good things, and not, like, for example, I don't think we should tear down national borders. I think these are a necessary thing that are required for the safety and protection of the people within the country, and so that would theoretically put me in supporting the status quo, but the way that the dialogue is going now, open borders is a very big topic that a lot of people are discussing, and it's like, well, I just oppose this, you know, so now I'm controversial. I suppose if you talk to the chap who's advocating for killing and rape and whatnot, then, I mean, what's the harm in advocating, in interviewing him? Because no one's going to adopt his worldview, you know, no one's going to agree with that.
Right. I mean, I interview him because it's revealing to a lot of people what they believe. But, I mean, even if your views are bad, even if they are, they are just disagreements, and we could talk about it. I don't really understand why it leads to so much hatred.
I really like talking to extremists for the same reason. You know, I like to know why they think what they think, you know, how they get into the headspace that they're in.
Right.
And, like, take on their set of beliefs. And then you get to see the connections between, like, one belief and another belief, and how that leads them down the path of, oh, it's okay to kill people, or whatever.
Right.
You know, and it's interesting to know, and it's important to know, I think, you know.
Right.
So you can see it in other people, and so you can explain to people, look, be careful about going down this path, because you end up having to accept a bunch of propositions that effectively make you unable to argue the case against what the extremists are saying.
Right.
So you kind of get sucked into it, and so I think that's important to know.
And also, there's extremists are not all lost. I mean, I know I met with a lot of ex-Nazis, ex-ISIS wannabes, right? So I don't think, like, a lot of people think, like, oh, those, even those people, I think we shouldn't give up on them. Even those people should be reached out to.
I completely agree. Yeah. One of the things that I'm constantly advocating against is ostracism, social ostracism.
Right.
Because you can never redeem someone by casting them out.
Right.
All you do is make them more confirmed in their beliefs, that, A, you can't argue against them, you're too afraid to even touch them, and that you're just going to be a perpetual enemy to that person.
Yeah.
And so that makes them completely solidified. No, I'm right, they're wrong, everything I say and do now is justified.
Right.
And it's terrible. It's a terrible thing.
So to be able to show people how you could disagree, I'm going to see if I could... I think some things that we're going to be disagreeing on, I'm going to try them, see where it goes. So you were mentioning about the school, the LGBT activists, and trying to teach LGBT related. And you were saying, correct me if I'm wrong, you agree with some of these Muslim protesters and the fact that they're trying to get LGBT teaching out of school for younger children. Why do you think that is?
Yeah. I think the Muslim parents and the activists in this regard are right, because they're not... I've done an interview with one that I'll be uploading soon, but they're not coming at it from a Quranic position. They're coming at it from within the British legal framework and saying that the parents... It really comes down to a question of who owns the children, who is going to be the one that dictates what the sort of social conditioning the children are going to be exposed to. And under British law, the children own the parents. The parents own the children. And so they are appealing to our traditional legal system. Say, well, look, we actually have the right to intervene if we think the school is teaching our children something we find inappropriate.
Right.
And that's totally fair. And then, so I went to Birmingham, I had an interview with a chap called Amir, and saw the books themselves, and I agree, I don't think this is necessarily appropriate. For example, one book was actively encouraging transgenderism, and the child represented in the book was only 4 years old. And to me, this is too young. I think that's ascribing sexual dimensions to them that the children themselves don't really hold.
Encouraging transgenderism?
Yeah, I would say it was encouraging.
Like, what was it saying exactly?
I took some pictures of the books, so I can show you.
I'm actually going to go there and see the books, yeah.
It was one of those... Yeah, I strongly recommend you do. Now, on its own, it's not necessarily the worst thing, and it sounds as if it is inclusion, and it is, but that's also part of the ideology behind it. Sorry, I've just got to...
Yeah, because... when you say the parents own the children, I don't necessarily, like, is that really in the law? Because I think nobody owns the children. I don't think anybody should own the children. I think they
have to.
Really?
Yeah, I think someone has to be who decides in the final decision for the child. You
know? So if the parents decides not to treat the, like, not give medicine to their children if they're sick, well, shouldn't the government step in?
Yeah, I do agree. These are the sort of complex questions that come into the question of the ownership of your own children.
Right.
But I think it's quite perturbing if we say the government owns, the state owns the children.
How about nobody owns the children and the government just steps in if they're not... The government...
Then you find yourself in a position where, say, both the parents died or something.
Right.
You know, what happens to the child then? You know, does it go to a family or does it go to an orphanage? You know, it, like...
So, but the government is responsible for taking care of its citizens, right?
I'm not even sure...
Protecting its citizens.
I'd say the government's job is to protect the rights of citizens.
Mm.
So, taking care, as soon as you frame it in that way, suddenly you're giving the government an ethical obligation to the personal, like, daily lives and needs of the citizens. I'm not sure that's actually the requirement of the government. I think that's something that we can have the government do if we agree as a society it makes the society more pleasant and a better society. I think, and I'm in agreement with that. I've had to use these services myself. But I think if we frame it as an imperative that the government has, then I think we end up opening the door to some quite authoritarian ideologies a bit further down the line.
Right. So, well, the way that you would frame it, would that make... Are you in favor of a government that makes it mandatory that children get educated to a certain level?
Yeah, I suppose I would be.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, so, and the government has to decide what are the things that are required for a child to know. Would that not include, like, so we know math is probably one of them, English is probably one of them, science, basic science is probably some of them, right? But what about...
Yes to those things, obviously. Right? But I am genuinely... it's a big conversation to talk about the sort of curriculums we teach in this country.
Right.
But there's a lot on there that I think actually doesn't need to be there.
Does
it?
Yeah.
It's not there that should be.
But yes. One thing that might be a good idea to keep on there is the understanding that there are other kinds of people there.
So, to me, this goes to a level that I'm not necessarily comfortable with myself. For example... This is the book. So it starts with, like, you know, it's for children. And I've got a 4-year-old boy.
Right.
So my princess boy is 4 years old. He likes pretty things. Pink's his favorite color. And then it goes through, essentially, he acts like a girl. And then, a princess boy can wear pink and I will tell him how pretty he looks. He can play with me in pretty girl clothes and I'll also play with him. Will you laugh? Will you call him a name? We love him for a year. So it is advocacy.
It doesn't tell you to do it yourself. It's just telling you, like...
It is incentivizing the kids to do that. Like, to make it as if it's the same as adopting a traditional gender role, which I don't think it is.
So, I mean, okay, so I let it... The way that it was...
But I'm not against... Sorry, right. I know I'm interrupting. Yeah. I just want to...
Clarify.
I'm not against the idea of treating children gently and fairly in these regards. Obviously, I don't want children to bully them.
Right.
But I do think there is a very detailed conversation that has to be had regarding this issue because, the number of children who are becoming transgender and taking hormone blockers that are not tested is very... I mean, BBC Newsnight did a piece about this where they were just interviewing the sort of 15-year-olds who are doing it. They're saying, well, yeah, these these drugs are untested, but we feel it's the right thing to do. And the thing is, a lot of these drugs are carcinogenic, they leave you infertile. The surgery itself is still quite experimental, I think.
Right.
And so it's a huge life-changing decision that gets made at 4 years old, or is, you know, encouraged to be normalised at 4 years old.
Right.
And I might sound like an awful conservative, but all I'm saying is, you know, as a parent, I'm looking at that and thinking, I'm not comfortable with this. You know, I don't think, like, I think a four-year-old is way too young to be able to understand any of these
right.
issues.
But, well, I mean, taking hormones or not, that's another scientific discussion, but this, just this by itself, without the hormones or anything, right? This is right past.
Yeah.
These should be legal. Government.
Yeah. Big government.
I will encourage the government to get involved in banning that. But,
yeah.
But, I mean, this is way less than, this book seems to me way less than encouraging kids to take hormones. And, I mean, think of, like,
the thing is, the book isn't in isolation. There's also a class plan that he took me through.
Right.
I don't have that. And there's the thing is, there's also the activist group and ideology that goes around it. For example, The Guardian, a very far-left publication, recently published a piece from a doctor who was the head of the Tavistock unit, I think it is, which is the transgender unit in the UK, the one transgender unit on the NHS. And he was saying how essentially it's being taken over by radical leftist ideologues. And he thinks that this is part of a process of effectively trying to skip over the legitimacy scientifically, you know, either way,
mm.
and try and essentially bring people into the fold to grow the ideology. And when, sorry, I know I'm
interrupting. No, go ahead. Sorry.
The chap who runs it, Moffat, he's a gay, intersectional, LGBT activist.
Right.
And so it's not in isolation. It's, you know, it's all in a context, and the context is the sort of radical left-wing LGBT ideology. And even then, I'm not saying, you know, kids should never know about it or anything like that.
Right.
I just think at the ages between, like, 5 and 9 is too young, because they're not going through puberty, they don't have any real understanding of themselves. And I think it's
so age
concerning.
Okay, so I don't know how radical it is. I'm going to go try to do it in my investigation myself to see. But would you, let's say, if the program was that we're just, even, you know, 5 to 9, okay? We're just going to show them some in some stories that there are other people, there are boys that are attracted to boys, there are girls that are attracted to girls, and there are boys that want to be girls and girls that want to be boys. If that was all that is, would you support that? If nothing else other than that?
Yeah, so the other two books that he brought out were books about King and King and Two Gay Penguins. I actually didn't find these particularly concerning, because there's no necessary life-changing operation or you know, drugs or anything that needs to be taken. You know, it could be a phase they're going through, it could be a life path they choose or find themselves on. I don't see that as being particularly harmful, but the idea of transgenderism at such a young age, when kids don't have a very good sense of self and personal identity anyway, let alone understanding the sort of gender roles and other identities of others, I do think that's a concerning thing.
But kids are really good at playing pretend. I mean, like, kids sometimes pretend to be cowboys and firemen, and that doesn't cause a crisis in identity. And
I know, but they're not really identities that people operate with in the world, are they?
What do you mean?
Well, I don't see any cowboys around, but I see lots of men and women.
But I'm saying that even if it's a boy that is not biologically transgender, right?
Mm.
And all of a sudden they pretend to be a girl for a while.
Yeah.
Because they're a biologically transgender, it's just gonna stop at some point, just like they stop pretending to be cowboys.
Well, yeah.
But the ones that seem like, oh, this seems more comfortable at all times, then they're gonna be like, well, I'm gonna continue being a girl.
No. I do think kids should have the freedom to explore that sort of thing.
Right.
But the problem is, you're acting as if this is being done in isolation. There appears to be some kind of pipeline with activists who will actively seek out people, children, who they think have had, you know, just any kind of, I mean...
Why, like, would they do that, though?
Well, ideological reasons, I think. I think it's kind of like a secular religion that they're pushing. An example of this, right? And this example just stuck in my head. So, I just couldn't get rid of it because it really bothered me. There was a case in the United States. I can't remember where now. It was a few years ago. I saw it. But a young boy, 6 or 7, had drawn a picture of himself in a purple and yellow jersey.
Right.
Or what looked, in fact, like a jersey. It looked like a dress, right? And so the teacher was like, this is proof that he's a girl or he wants to be a girl. And essentially, it started the mechanisms of trying to, draw him away from his family and push him down the route of becoming transgender. Until the parents finally saw the drawing and they were like, no, this is a football jersey. It had the number 7 on for his favourite player and stuff like this. But the activists didn't see that at all. They didn't know anything about football. They were just like, oh, he wants to be a girl, he wants to be a girl. We're going to push this. And so that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. I agree that if you've got a young kid, a young boy who's like, I really feel like a girl. I remember when I was at school, there was a kid who played with dolls and stuff. He was always playing with the girls and playing with dolls. He's probably transitioned by our age,
Right.
But I think that having a group of activists who are essentially trying to push that is going to create a lot more false positives than expected.
So would you be okay if it wasn't, I don't know how, I'm going to go figure out how radical it is, but would you be okay with a version of this that was just an introduction to the fact that there are people, even if it's not introducing, imagine if you were gay and you just think that there's something wrong with you growing up. A lot of people think that there's a lot of shaming, a lot of kids are bullied. Yeah. Even for the kids that are cis or, and straight, they might bully other kids less if they've been introduced to this idea in their books. It might encourage less bullying of the kids that are gay, right? So if it was just an introduction that, there are different kids out there, would you be okay with that?
I think if I could identify... I think if it was done in an obviously secular way,
right,
so it was factual presentation,
right,
sure, that's obvious.
Because the Muslim...
But I don't think that's not the sort of culture that is being produced in.
Okay. But that version that you're okay with, I don't think the Muslim activists, they would not be okay with even that.
Well, to be honest with you, when I say that I'm okay with it, I'm still kind of on the cusp.
Right.
Because, to me, it's adding a dimension of life that the children of that age are just not, they just don't have any understanding of.
Well, so when this was first, when I heard the Muslims talk about this and a lot of people, conservatives, talking about it, it seemed to me like this, that they're showing them gay porn or something.
They're a bit hyperbolic.
Yeah. But the level of sexuality the kids are exposed to with these books is the same as what they see in Snow White or Sleeping Beauty. In fact, these are the same, these are the same people that make fun of social justice warriors for saying that Snow White and Sleeping Beauty were kissed without consent, so you're encouraging rape culture, and we're like, wow, you're ruining our childhood, right? But there was actual kissing in that scene, and they are now are complaining about books that doesn't even have kissing in it because they're not straight. So the sexuality that the kids are already exposed to, that's the same level that they're being exposed to, maybe just with being gay now. So, or
true,
even less.
I think there is a genuine qualitative difference between being straight and being, or cisgender and being transgender.
Why?
Because most transgender people are not happy. There's a huge amount of mental illness. They've got increased cancer risk because of the drugs they take. They have genuine difficulty forming relationships.
Right. But so normalizing it might help. But
I don't think there's that much you can actually do in this regard, because at the end of the day, you can say, well, I'm very, very tolerant of trans people, but then their dating life is still very difficult, even in progressive communities,
right,
in Portland and places like this,
right,
it's still difficult.
Well,
I think there are natural imperatives that we have to admit to,
right,
in these regards, and I think that the intersectional types, the blank slaters, who want to divorce the biological reality of being male and female from the gender roles of man and woman, I think that's dangerous and I think it's wrong.
Yep. The thing is that if there's some misery and sadness that they're going to always be exposed to, and that doesn't mean that we can't help reduce it, even if we can't eliminate it, right? And maybe normalizing it to an extent might help them at least feel accepted, even if they are still going to have other challenges in their life.
Have you noticed that we're never considering the alternative, though?
What's the alternative?
Well, for example, if you're a particularly effeminate man, and you're not sure if you're going to transition them, wouldn't it be a lot easier to give them testosterone and make them into a more masculine man, so they would feel more comfortable in their male gender role?
Well, my understanding, and somebody correct me in the comments if I'm wrong
about this. Yeah, I'm no expert.
Yeah. So my understanding is that the brain is, so let's say I'm born in a male body, mm-hmm. right? The brain is a female brain. No amount of hormones is going to change my brain. So let me say.
Yep.
So the point is to change the hormones so that the hormones match my brain,
yep.
right? So the thing is that the most of this psychological issues that is because the hormones are not matching my brain. You know, I have male hormones and a female brain.
I'm completely on board with that argument, right. But there's also the other side that says there is no male or female brain.
Yeah, I've seen studies that they...
Oh, they definitely are. They definitely are. The people who I agree with you. I think that probably is going to be the case. But again, I'm no expert on the science. And if the other side is right, then why do they only have a one-sided solution?
No, the explanation is one-sided solution is because I can change hormones, but you can't change a brain, right? So if you have a male brain, I need to change the hormones to match the brain.
Well, I'm not an expert on brain science, so you can quote me.
You can't transplant.
This is the thing. If the other side is saying, well, actually, the structures in the brain are as they are because of certain hormones anyway.
No, it's not because...
Well, like I said, I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just listening to their arguments because, like...
The brain is... if you have a female brain, it's not because of the hormones.
Right.
You're born with that brain.
Right, okay.
And the hormones are, because you're in a male, like let's say you're a female brain, but you're in a male body, so the hormones are going to be male, right? So since we can't switch the brain to match your hormones, we need to switch the hormones to match your brain.
I think that's
a very simplified, unscientific version.
To me, that all sounds totally reasonable.
Okay.
But I've heard convincing arguments from the other side.
Okay.
That also, to me, like I said, as a layman on this,
right.
I'm like, right, okay, that sounds, you know, not implausible either. And so I'm not entirely sure where I stand on it, because I'm not really sure what I'm supposed to believe.
Right.
Because it's a really complex subject.
So,
but yeah. there are, even if, let's assume your scenario, even if we have that, there are still other knock-on effects. For example, I think being frivolous with gender roles is a very dangerous thing. And I don't think that it was really understood because it seems so innate. Most people, like 99.9% of people, probably identify with the gender, like the sexual, males identify as men, women identify as, females identify as women.
Yeah.
In a almost overwhelmingly, 99 point whatever percent. So there's definitely a kind of stability there. But then when you start attacking these things, either ideologically or politically or whatever, you start creating people who I think have less of a sense of self and are less centered and become insecure and unsure of themselves. And not only that, they seem to lose meaning in their life. I mean, look at like millennials now. They just, I hate kids, I'm lonely, I'm bored, I'm depressed, I have all these mental illnesses. 100 years ago, you didn't really have these things because people formed families and there was quite a strong sense of these things. And I think that
100 years ago?
Well, however many,
okay.
Through human history.
But we're living better lives now.
Well, that's the question, though. Like, are we?
Yeah.
People aren't happy.
People are happier now. People are...
I don't know if they are. I think women aren't, certainly.
I mean, okay, so if you look at what we're upset about these days, we're upset about not being able to pay our bills, working too hard.
Yeah.
Being lonely instead of being unhappy because my wife just died in childbirth.
Hey, I totally agree.
My
right?
third child also died from disease.
I totally agree, right? But the thing is, if people are if the overall levels of happiness are reduced,
right,
then are we living a life that we want to live if we're not happy?
The level of happiness right now, I mean, we have less violence, less crime, more longer lives, more connection,
and people are miserable.
I mean, people were
but they're more isolated as well.
people are more miserable.
Less poverty than ever before.
Like, yeah, but a third millennials don't have one friend.
But did you? How did you?
That's crazy, isn't it?
But how, did they have friends like the
previous generations? Yeah, had many more friends.
You're looking. Do you have a measurement of happiness?
It's always self-reported, obviously. But like, it's just people. You know, when they do a survey, people report their levels of happiness, and women's levels of happiness have gone down. And like, for example, Vox the other day published a piece on how lonely millennials are. I mean, like, 9% of boomers said they had no friends, 20% of my generation, Gen X, said they had no friends, and 30%+ of millennials have got no friends. So we're producing lonely, isolated societies.
I think if you look at short term, things might be going up and down, but if you look at longer term, things are improving.
100 years or so.
But 100 years, we've...
Socially, I don't think they are. I think socially, they're going... Really
so we need to actually do... Like, I personally think, like, I'd rather be upset that I have less friends than being upset that my wife is dead.
Right? I'm not advocating we abandon, you know, like...
I mean, race...
Like, you know, medicine or something.
I mean, even when it comes to social stuff, right? Yeah. So if you look at, like, how black people were treated, right? And, you know, right now, it's, you know, when it comes to racism, women's rights, when it comes to, I mean, xenophobia is much less, as much as a lot of people on the left wanted to make it, you know, regressive left, wanted to make it look, seem like everything is really, really bad. We have made a lot of progress on those things, right? Our rights, our freedoms, even when it comes to, not just medicine, even when it comes to social stuff, we have made a lot of progress, right? So I think, like, what we're saying with the regressive left, it's just a short overcorrection that I don't think that it's going to last. Like, an example that I want to give to you is, like, you know, do you know the Red Scare?
Yeah.
So that was very similar to what we're dealing with right now when it comes to social justice warriors.
Yeah.
If you think about it, everybody was being accused of being a communist.
Everybody's a racist. Yeah,
everybody is now Nazi, like that everybody was a communist. They thought the communist Russia is going to take over every day, United States is going to fall, just like these people think Nazis are back. Now we know communist Russia was not a communist, the Soviet Union was never in a position to take down the United States at that point, right? It was even worse because the government was involved. Right now they're not arresting people, not yet at least, but FBI was involved. Like, they said, like, oh, you met with, we have a picture of you shaking the hand of this guy that was at this labor meeting, you're a communist. If you ever said, like, workers' rights, you're a communist. If you were ever in a union, you're a communist, right? And it was, and people were getting arrested, people were losing their jobs, right? And now now we look at it a little bit, that was ridiculous, right? We can see that that was ridiculous. And it came, it caused a lot of damage, and I think this might be something that's similar.
I agree. I agree with the comparison to the SJWs to the McCarthy era.
Right.
But I have a funny feeling that at the time it probably didn't seem as ridiculous. It's easy to look in hindsight and say, right, well, you weren't there at the time, you didn't have the fear of the communists. And they appear to be taking over the world, you know, Russia, China, you know, there's a lot was being lost to communism, if you think about it. So I think it's easy to in reverse for the McCarthy era, because I think the communists did pose an existential threat to Western freedom.
Actually, another interesting similarity is that the actual Russian spies benefited from all this fear, because harder to detect them, because everybody was,
oh, it's because I'm Russian.
So just like the alt-right today is benefiting from all this over-accusation.
But the thing that I think we haven't considered, though, I'm not trying to suggest that the Enlightenment was a bad idea or anything like that. I'm a very strong proponent of Enlightenment values. But I think that with any kind of order, any civilizational structure, whichever way it's ordered, it's always going to be ordered in a way that's infallible and imperfect, that creates the underside, that's the negative aspect of it. And I think that a lot of proponents of the Enlightenment want to believe that we had all the answers. And I don't think we did have all of the answers. We had a lot more of the answers than most.
Right.
But we didn't have them all. For example, the declining happiness, the corresponding decline of women's happiness to women's freedom is something I think is concerning. And I think I personally seen a lot of young women become very conservative, socially conservative.
Right.
In recent years, Lindsay Shepherd is actually a really great example of this, because before she got accosted by the SJW mafia in Wilfrid Laurier, she was a fairly unthinking progressive. But I've watched her YouTube channel and her interviews with other people now, and she's, you know, against pornography, she's against all sorts of what she considers these social ills, and very, very, very conservative. And she's not the only one. There are lots of other young, you know, attractive, intelligent young women who are like, you know what, I kind of want to go back to Patreon. It's essentially what they're saying. And so it's like, I think there's a social aspect that is being overlooked. I mean, and corresponding to this, young men are committing suicide at incredibly high rates. And that just, I mean, there's got to be something wrong when young men are the oppressive demographic of society that are killing themselves.
Well, men
probably got the wrong.
I think men's suicide rates were always higher than women.
Yeah. Of course, but yeah, they're going up.
Oh, cool.
And so this is a concern. Why in an era of the most free societies for personal choices that have ever existed, are women becoming unhappy and men killing themselves?
Okay, I need to see some data to show.
I can
show.
Send you the.
Okay, charts. Okay. I want to see if there's actual measure of happiness, because the only thing I see that is reliable, like data that we could see that is changing, is child mortality rates, women dying at childbirth, disease, hunger. Yeah. Those are the things that we could see. Yeah. I don't know how we can measure happiness changing.
We've got to do it through self-reporting.
Right.
But they have been doing it. And there are studies that show this. I'll send you all the stuff afterwards.
That's okay. Of course.
But I think that there's... I think the loneliness of millennials is what's contributing to this, and I think effectively the kind of social atomization that is reinforced by people's claims on one another.
Right.
So moral claims. So, for example, if you're going to present yourself as a man, you're going to act like a man, and then you slam the door in a woman's face or something, I might say to you, that's not gentlemanly, right, and I'm making a moral claim to your behaviour on the basis of how I expect you to act given how you present yourself.
Right.
And this is a social function. And the social function is to make sure that men are not actually oppressing women in society. So, you know, you should show a bit of respect to the lady, but in return, she's got to act like a lady. There's a social expectation on her part. And I think this was a kind of social fabric that's been worn away and is becoming quite frayed.
So I'm going to respond to that, but before going what you said about enlightenment, the thing, as an atheist activist and somebody that supports enlightenment values, I supported Enlightenment values, even though Voltaire was very much against atheism.
Yes.
Locke was very much against atheism, right? But the point of Enlightenment is not that these are the right views. The point of Enlightenment is like, we should create an environment where we could go and hunt for the right views. We could be able to express ideas,
totally,
right?
Right?
So it's about the continue. Like, it's not about here's the solution.
Mm-hmm.
It's a process, not the answer, right?
Yeah.
So that's what I like about it. So even if they come up with wrong answers, it's not a job done, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's where my opposition to teaching 5-year-olds trans ideology is coming from. I think there is something about the human experience that is communal and a lot more difficult to put your finger on. And I think the religion is something that serves that function. But it doesn't have to be religion. I think what we've seen by the rise of social justice and socialism, frankly, as a sort of social movement, as a social force, is there's a desire to belong to a community that has purpose, to imbue meaning into one's life.
Well, I think enlightenment could provide that. We could create communities around dedication to enlightenment values.
I think that can happen. I agree. But I think that in general, it probably won't happen. I think the more sort of traditional things that make families and communities are probably easier to just get along with.
Well, traditional things didn't used to be traditional. They were all, at some point, they were all introduced. So we could introduce new ways.
We absolutely can, but I don't think that the LGBT lobby is introducing a healthy thing.
Well,
I think what they're introducing is probably going to be unhealthy.
Well, I mean, I will try to figure that out. But with regards to the people being lonely, another thing that came from Enlightenment is like Adam Smith, right? So the idea of free markets and supply and demand. And I think if you create, and again, that's a more right-wing thing, even though it's part of the Enlightenment, right? So it's which is something I support. But I'm just saying, if you keep advocating for that, if people are suffering from loneliness, there would be, if we create environments where those ideas are flourishing, mm-hmm. there would be something that would be in respond to that. There would be a service. There would be a market. Like, if people are upset about something or want something, there would be a market for it.
Yeah.
And that demand will eventually be, you know.
I think that's what we're seeing with the sort of intersectional social justice rise. I think that it's fulfilling the function of a religion and the sort of free market desire to self-associate with something.
Well, I mean, this is why I don't think religion and social justice warrior culture is not free market, because they both have government support. And I think if we had, you know, they don't pay taxes, they even get supported by the religion. So I think if people like people that were supporting Enlightenment values, if we had fair competition, I think we would have been the ones that would be filling those holes instead of religion.
I think we're getting away from religion specifically, as social justice activism, I've seen it come up in a way that is, there is a grassroots for it, but it is also supported by all the institutions.
Right.
So it's a movement that's gone up very, very quickly and then taken root in the governing structures of society and the state itself. And it does have its activists. But I think that the thing it's going to end up creating is going to cause more damage than the reverse.
Because I agree with that, but I'm just saying that it's not fair competition.
Oh, right? I totally agree. Yeah,
so it's not really a free market situation.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
But regards to men roles and women roles, I do agree that nothing should be pushed, but I also think that I don't want to go back to tradition, but I don't want anything to be pushed as well, because what we have with traditional values is that they're also pushing something, right? So I think if, like, for example, right, I started cooking and I wash the dishes while listening to podcasts, and I enjoy that.
Yeah, me too.
But, yeah, there you go.
My wife does the cooking, I do the cleaning, but I
right.
listen to
it. Yeah. And I can't fix shit.
Yeah,
and my wife fixes everything that breaks in the house.
Me too. My wife fixed our shower the other day, and I'm like, does this make me unmanly? I was genuinely thinking, should I have fixed that shower instead? I'm not even joking.
But I mean, okay. So here's what I think the overcorrection is, right? So if I have a daughter, and she starts liking cars instead of like dolls, I'm not gonna tell her, no, you like dolls.
Yeah,
right. And I'm not going to do the other way either. I think both of these camps are pushing something, right? So the traditional people are like, oh, my daughter is acting like a boy. That's not good. And the other, you know, if the other side is like, my daughter is liking Barbies, that's, you know, very gender
that's
a stereotype.
Yeah.
No, go like have multiple. Yeah. What if your daughter likes pink? Let her like pink.
Yeah.
I think if you just, I don't want to go back to tradition, and I don't want to push anything either. I just think, just letting people find their preferences is something.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I don't push anything on my kids. You know, I try not to.
Right.
Even with my concerns, you know, I try not to be overbearing or anything like that, because I think stifling kids' creativity and exploration of themselves is probably a bad thing. I mean, my parents didn't do it to me, and I've got no desire to do it to my kids. But I'm just speaking on a wider societal level, though. I think we've got to account for those people who are effectively the meddling busybodies,
right?
Like, you know, from the either side, you know, the traditionalist right and the, you know, extreme progressive left,
right?
Who are like, no, you know, it's got to be our way. And we've got to account for those people existing,
yes,
and they're going to be interfering in everything. And I think that when it comes to like the intersectional side, we can have space for it. We can have space for it, but I think a line has to be firmly drawn. And I think prepubescent children can be that firm line. It's like, no, they just don't need to know. You know, it's something they can worry their heads about when they're getting a little bit older and have a bit more understanding.
Right. So one last thing I say before because I took so much of your time, thank you. I just, you know, a lot of these, you know, two things actually. Sometimes we forget to also, I think it's important that when we're going after the regressive left, not to forget that we also need to keep defending the other side against the other far right people. So I think, and also it, anything that we have against the regressive left comes up as stronger if we have a strong portfolio of taking jabs at the far right. And I think
I think, like you said earlier, the far right hate me.
Yeah.
Passion more than they hate the far left.
Right. Yeah.
So I think I've done my job there. Yeah. You know, so I don't think I have to worry about that too much.
Another thing I think is important to recognize, I think, is that a lot of these regressive leftists are jumping on the bandwagon of, you know, using movements that did a lot of good.
Mm.
Like, they're just overcorrecting, right? Like, you know, so, and I'm afraid that pushing back against social justice warriors and against the regressive left is going to take some, you know, the Generation Z to a position that's going to devalue, or they're going to be turned off by the original movements. Like, you know, so I want to make sure that while we are attacking the regressive left, at the same time we defend people that are fighting against homophobia, against transphobia, against racism, you know, so doing that alongside of the people that are doing the overcorrection and going overboard, and instead of asking for equality or asking for privileges, I think it's important that we do that side by side. Do you agree?
I completely agree. I mean, I agree in countries like Iran or Saudi Arabia or something like that, you know, I think that someone like Raif Badawi, for example, you know, or there was someone in Poland who was recently arrested for doing an LGBT Mother Teresa.
Yes.
You know, these are things that I obviously strongly disagree with. The problem I think we have, though, is the sort of hard left lobby at the moment in the West is incredibly strong, and they're incredibly paranoid, and they are ratcheting up the rhetoric in a ridiculous manner. I mean, I'm sure you've seen the various Twitter trends that have been going on the past couple of days. Donald Trump is not a white nationalist. He's not. I don't even think he's a racist, to be honest. I think he's just a belligerent old man. Like, I don't think he's like the radical left wing interpretation is that he's essentially leading the new KKK, and it's like the culture that they exist in has gone mad, as far as I'm concerned. And so I think,
but that doesn't
stop.
Okay, but the radical left is not most of the left.
Well, they're loudest. Leading the left.
Yes,
that's
but they're
the problem.
Yeah, because most of the left has jobs and
careers. But they're leading it. They're driving the agenda. I mean, look at the wall, right? There's no moral problem with a wall on a border. There's no moral objection. You know, it's not racist. It discriminates against everyone. You know, it doesn't infringe on the rights of the people on the other side. It's completely within the rights of the people who own, you know, who are the citizens of a country to put a wall around their country. It doesn't hurt anyone. It doesn't change anything. And yet Nancy Pelosi, who herself is a centrist, flat refused to compromise on this wall. It was just like, nope, this is a red line. We're not going to go past this line. And I said, but this is a really silly thing to draw a red line on, because a wall it's not racist, you know? There's nothing wrong with it. It could have been a win. She could have got whatever Medicaid or whatever she wanted. She could have said, right, okay, we'll give you all if you give us all of this stuff. And that's how Trump negotiates as well. He wrote in his book. So you could have just gone, okay, we'll grab this. But instead, there was a firm line drawn by the sort of the squad types, the hard left types, on like, no, not at all.
So, but if we get into that, that would be another 1 hour conversation.
Yeah, I know.
They're
driving the left agenda.
Right.
And I don't like it.
Just to give you an example, you know, you mentioned right other places. I just want to point out that other places are situation are a lot worse. But
yeah.
I live in Vancouver, which is one of the most LGBT friendly cities in the whole world, and I have a transgender friend, Jack. There is, you know, and he mentioned to me, he came to our show on Atheist Republic, and he mentioned that he's been beaten up twice for being transgender in Vancouver, right? And a lot of transgender people that I talk to, they're like, you know, washroom stuff, you know, pronouns and stuff don't matter to me.
Yeah.
What matters
not
to me,
assaulted,
not being assaulted. Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying it matters or not, but I'm just saying there's a lot of people within, you know, that we don't hear from that I think that a lot of people that may, on the right, not on the far right, just the normal sane right, if they hear it from a lot of people on the left, they might find more things, because I think that
I mean, one of the main problems we have is nobody listens to the other side anymore,
right?
You only ever listen to the talking heads representation of the other side. And I, something I tell people all the time, I've got a list of
progressive and conservative content creators that I always recommend. And I'm like, look, you know, these are reliably partisan,
right,
but not irrational.
Right.
And so they're not like, you know, chest-thumping zealots, but they are in favour of their cause. Excuse me. But generally, they're pretty good. Like, I recommend Kyle Kalinske, David Pakman, a couple of others for left-wing content. And I'll recommend Stephen Crowder, and, you know, like Ben Shapiro for the right wing. So if you watch both of these, you'll find yourself with quite a well-informed view of what each side thinks of the political environment.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can distill your own opinions accordingly. And this is why I also follow like the alt-right types and the radical left types and the socialists. And you know, the communists, the transgender. I follow it all. You know.
Yeah, I follow all that.
Yeah, and so you, and I think you have to, just to understand what it is that you aren't, if nothing else.
Right.
But I think there's a very unhealthy habit of just falling down into one category and going, you know, following just only things that refer to this subject from these perspectives on your social media feeds, and then suddenly the other side, I mean, Reza Aslan is just declaring all of Trump's supporters to be white nationalists and evil.
Yeah, I saw that. I think he lost it. Yeah, but that's a good example, because I saw a lot of left wing people mm-hmm. saying that's nuts.
But this is the point. The right is very good at extracting the white nationalists from its midst. For example, like the Conservative National Conference, Richard Spencer wasn't allowed in. But the left wing ones, they're full of socialists and people who identify as communists. The left is very, very bad at extracting its most radical elements.
I mean, I would be in support of allowing even Richard Spencer to come to an event here. So
you're kind of opening the door then, aren't you? You know, I mean, I actually agree with the Conservatives. It's like, that ideologically, like, for example, Tulsi Gabbard is never going to become a communist. So why would Tulsi Gabbard want to host any left-wing event that would allow communists in? Because it's a completely different philosophy.
I mean, okay, I'm very, very, very much against communism. And I have communist friends.
Yeah.
I have communist friends, though. I mean, do you think I shouldn't have communist friends?
Yeah, because how else are you going to deprogram them?
No,
that's the reason. I've got white nationalist friends
right.
who I'm currently liberalizing, and I've noticed them becoming softer in their opinions.
Right.
You know, because of my friendship with them.
But even I have some communist friends. Even I'm a capitalist, right? Mm-hmm. I'm a free market. I believe in free markets and all. But the communist friends that I have, I told them like, "Hey, I'm a free market capitalist. Are you okay with working with me?" They're ex-Muslim,
yeah,
and they're fighting for ex-Muslim rights. I'm like, yeah, what we're doing has nothing to do with market, you know, the economy, right? So we work with each
other. If you're in a political party,
right,
then I think you do have to be wary of ideological entryism.
Right.
For example, like, in this country, the Labour Party has been taken over by communists. And I genuinely mean that in the literal sense. Like, literal communists are effectively driving the agenda of the Labour Party. That wasn't possible during the sort of preceding decades because of an explicit desire to keep the trots out, in the same way that the Republicans explicitly keep the white nationalists out. And I think that's important because these are subversive elements that will effectively kind of poison the party. And I think that's happened with the DNC, with the Democratic Party and the socialist left.
Right.
Because, I mean, like, for me, I just look at it and think Tulsi Gabbard is in the wrong party. She sounds like a Republican to me.
You know? Which one of the candidates do you like the most?
I love Tulsi. I really love Tulsi. I love the fact she's not, you know, she's not a neoliberal, and she's not a communist. You know, I really like her, but she's got no hope in hell of winning anything.
No, she is.
And it's gutting. So I'm with Trump. I'm like, well, he's the least bad of all of the options, in my opinion.
Can I tell you? I mean, I don't like Trump, but not for the same reasons other people. Like, honestly, I don't care about his language. I don't care about his tweet. But he, and this is, I'm against Trump for the same reason I'm against Obama.
Oh, there you go.
Both of them supported, both of them sold weapons to Saudi Arabia, knowing they're going to be dropped on innocent civilians. Right?
Unfortunately, that's a feature of our governments. I like you.
And Trump increased it.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, people are talking about, you know, this Trump says this and this, the amount of effect that the people he has based on the things that he tweets on racism or not, mm-hmm. is nothing compared to how many people are starving right now because Saudi Arabia used American weapons to destroy ports, knowing that this is the where food and medicine is coming in. They are using starvation as a weapon against children, and the United States knew that and still sold weapons to Saudi Arabia, even though it's against the United States' own constitution that they're not allowed to sell weapons to a country knowing that it's going to be used in this way.
This is why I'd like Tulsi to win.
Right.
Because she's not going to do that.
Okay.
She's... At least I don't think she would do it. I mean, you know, I don't want to... I don't think she would do that. I think she would be. I mean, she's called it out many times.
Right. You know. So between the, okay, if the, even though I'm a free market capitalist, yeah. Right? So I don't like Bernie Sanders. I don't like his social economic policies, but I will support him over Trump because Trump will support Saudi Arabia, and Bernie would not.
That's true. But for me, I think the domestic social issues are something we've got to take care of.
And honestly, but this is a bigger thing right now. This is the world's largest humanitarian crisis of our time.
I agree. But Trump isn't the only link in that chain.
It's a big link.
Exactly. I know. But it's also a feature of the American government. I think that like you say, Obama did the same. I think regardless of what
he increased it.
Yeah.
By a lot.
I think they're all going to. You know, I think
Bernie will cut it.
You would have to have someone who's specifically and explicitly against it, though.
Right, that's, like Bernie.
Yeah, like Bernie. Yeah, but that's or Tulsi. I think. Yeah. But that's not really Trump's sort of wheelhouse.
And he so you said just it get, was.
Wow. Yeah, he says he a promise. Lot of fucking things. Yeah. Like you know, you Steve Bannon always says you got to separate the signal from the noise with Trump, and I think that's very true. But I think.
But that was one of the main things he ran on.
Yeah,
he said, like, we need to bring our troops home. We're doing policing all around the world.
Yeah, but, like, and again, like, the institution that is the American Empire, effectively, is essentially independent of the president. Like, he'll set the direction, but
Tulsi and Bernie will cut this.
They would go against it as much as they could, certainly.
I mean,
but I don't think they'll have maybe they would.
This is one of the few things that the president will have full authority.
Really?
Yeah, like the no, when it comes
to... I haven't been following you.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, and I agree with you, it's, you know, but that's, for me, that's what I expect from the American government, regardless of president. So you've just got to live with it. I mean, like, one of the things I would love to do is get off oil. If there was a way to, you know, like nuclear power, electric cars, like get off oil, I would love to return Saudi Arabia to a desert state. I don't want having my money.
Yeah.
I don't like Saudi Arabia as a country. I don't like the things they do. I don't like their domestic, you know, situations. On a moral level, I find the country offensive.
Yeah.
I would be more than happy to never have to buy or sell anything from them again. But I accept the, I'll get it. But it's the status quo. What are you going to do? But
I think there's a lot we could do.
I'm not against the idea. But the thing is, there are so many domestic issues that I think are really important. I honestly think it's only Trump that's going to stand up to the radical left. I don't think anyone else has got the fortitude to do it, because the social pressure they can muster gets everyone to bow, and Trump is just standing there saying, "I don't care." And that to me is a really I don't know why it feels so important, but it really does.
Okay.
I think there's a genuine.
Don't you think that hundreds of thousands of people starving is more important than the regressive left?
Well, it depends where you are. Like, there are people starving all over the world all the time. There's always suffering.
Well, I mean, then you could say the same thing about the regressive left, because we have communists somewhere else.
Yeah.
So they're bigger deal than the regressive left.
I suppose that you focus on the thing that's in front of you, don't you?
Oh no, because Saudi Arabia is not in front of me, and I'm focusing on it.
Well, it's the sort of area of the world you're from, it's sort of that region.
I mean, it's not Iran. I mean, proximity is not important to me. Do you care about more? I mean, you care about more U.S. politics than France, and France is closer to you.
The U.S. politics comes over here. We're about a year and a half behind U.S. politics. Anything that happens in America, about a year later, it starts happening.
I mean, I'm not focusing on Saudi Arabia because it was closer to where I was born. I'm focusing on it because they're responsible for the current most greatest humanitarian crisis of our time. If that was happening in Africa or Yemen, it doesn't matter. The location doesn't matter.
But, well, I mean, you have my complete support in the fight against Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, yeah.
But well, I feel that my skills are best used.
Okay, I see. Well, on that note, we agree on that then. Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Real pleasure.
Atheists are under attack in many places. If they were Christians, their voices would be heard. If they were Jews, their voices would be heard. If they were Muslims, their voices would be heard. But they are atheists, and not many seem to be listening. Let's make it difficult for them to ignore us. We have built a global community, and now we are tearing down geographic, cultural, and language barriers so we can find each other and support each other. In the last decade, we have built the largest atheist community in the world. Now we're doing the same in other languages. With your help, we have started Atheist Republic in Persian and Arabic.
انضميت مؤخرا لأسرة Atheist Republic وحيصير عندي بودكاست باللغة العربية.
As we grow, we can dedicate more time, staff, and resources to start doing the same in Spanish, Portuguese, Malay, Bengali, Urdu, Hindi, and other languages. We are providing community, support, informative content, and amplifying the voices of those who need protection, especially in countries where people feel isolated simply for their lack of belief. We want to be there for them, and we are only getting started. Help us get there. Check in the description for ways you can support our projects.